The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, which is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here, a writer for The Nation. This week, we're going to take up 2 old favorites. One is a favorite subject, Barry Weiss, who from some perspectives can be seen as one of the major monsters of our time, at least in the world of media. And the other favorite is frequent guest of the program, David Kleon, who writes for The Nation, Jewish Currents, and many other publications, and who I think should be credited as the world's foremost Barry Weiss expert. I think he's like monitored her career more than anyone. And she's been in the news lately. Recently, there were some firings of like senior producers and reporters at 60 Minutes. And that's reopened the whole issue of Barry Weiss and what exactly she's up to. So without further ado, David, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, as always. I'm going to work with the assumption that people who are listening to this have a basic idea who Barry Weiss is. And
yeah, we've covered her before in the podcast. I'll link to some articles if people want more background. But I mean, yeah. What's her current position? What is she like?
Well, I'm gonna assume people are up to speed. I mean, her current position is editor-in-chief of CBS News, and depending on which media reporter you trust, she may or may not have that power over CNN in the near future, too. Mm-hmm. But the way I want to frame this, my thinking on her right now, she's been at the CBS job for, what, like 8 or 9 months now? Or it was announced 8 or 9 months ago. We've had some time to observe some patterns. And I want to say, I think among Barry watchers, and there are a lot of Barry watchers, there are basically 2 schools of thought about Barry's tenure at CBS. And I am of one school of thought, but I know many intelligent people, friends of the show and so on, who are of the other. And of course, the truth is probably somewhere in between. So one school of thought, which is not mine, but it is a popular one. It's one that I've seen, for instance, Adam Johnson espouse, or Owen Higgins, who we both know, says that Barry is doing everything she is doing for a single audience, which is David Ellison, who hired her, and ultimately for Donald Trump. The sole function of everything that Barry does is to make Donald Trump happy so he approves the Warner Brothers Paramount merger, which is all but finalized. Barry understands that. Larry and David Ellison understand that. Everything that we think looks like a disaster is actually a success because it's humiliating the libs. It's destroying one of their beloved institutions, CBS News, 60 Minutes. It's, you know, showing that Barry is this unstoppable force that could just wreck anything in our path without consequences. As Owen puts it, always bet on Barry, Bob. So that's one school of thought. It's basically like, and to put a more big picture gloss on it than just kind of like mystifying Barry and her, you know, destructive genius or whatever, I think this is really a school of thought about the political economy of the second Trump era, in which what we're saying is what you thought capitalism was about, namely like products perform well, causing, you know, their stock to go up, causing them to become more valuable, and that, you know, basically that in some way, like that there's some relationship between producing normal shareholder value through like actual qualitative innovations that's obsolete. And in fact, we live under like a Putinist gangster state in which the actual value of anything is totally wrapped up in the relationship between the oligarch who owns it and the regime. So the only thing that matters is what is the Ellison family's relationship to Donald Trump. CBS News is a rounding error. Network News is going to be obsolete soon. Barry is spectacularly succeeding. She's dizzy with success. That's one school of thought. That is not my school of thought, though I acknowledge that some of it is probably true, and it's worth taking seriously. My school of thought, the other school of thought, is that while it is true that the Ellisons want to suck up to Donald Trump, and while it's true that putting Barry Weiss in charge of CBS News is part of how they're doing that, and that's clearly true, that Barry Weiss actually does believe her own, believes that she is an actual media genius who understands what, like, the median American news consumer wants. She believes that her tastes are, like, the correct tastes. She has tastes. She is trying to run CBS News successfully, successfully according to the metrics we would normally associate with success. Like, its ratings go up. She is obviously, if that's true, spectacularly failing at it. Like, could not be doing a worse job. It's really remarkable. It fills those of us who espouse this view with a certain amount of schadenfreude. It's really fun to see Barry fail. It's really fun to see her failure be, as we see it, unmistakable. She is clearly very, very bad at running a TV news channel. It's hilarious. On the other hand, as Owen points out to me regularly, she is still in charge of CBS News. And it still seems very much on the table that she could take over CNN. Though here's where things get interesting, because, you know, CBS is such a leaky place right now that there must be at least half a dozen media reporters who are basically on the full-time Barry beat, publishing virtually every day dispatches from inside CBS News, which, by the way, is not something you normally associate with an organization that's being well-run. Usually when an organization's being well-run, it means that people generally like and trust the boss and want to keep working for them, at least on balance, and therefore don't leak lightly. But clearly everybody at CBS is leaking constantly to every single news organization, because it's fairly obvious the vast majority of people working at CBS News hold Barry in utter contempt. She is reviled. So again, the question is that winning or losing from the Ellisons' point of view? Is it good or bad that Barry is despised by every single one of the, I think, several thousand people who work for her? Like, what does that mean? So I'm curious which side of this divide you fall on, Jeet, or if you think that it's a false choice or there's some other way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, like, first of all, I think you laid it out very clearly. And I have to say, I think I'm actually, like, on the other side, in the sense that I don't think she's engaged in a business operation, except to the extent that it is a business operation geared towards pleasing billionaires. It's a business operation with a small audience in mind. Now, I will say, maybe I'll expand it beyond saying she wants to please just Donald Trump and the Ellison family. I think there's a wider cohort of billionaires, Silicon Valley billionaires, that are also her audience. And beyond them, I think that there's a cohort of sort of like people who aren't like ultra wealthy, but are, let's say, like upper middle class, classic neoconservative types.
Right.
People who are like maybe liberal. Huh? The free press audience. The free press audience. People who are like, I would say, doctors, lawyers who have succeeded in the American meritocracy, who are socially liberal in a sort of 1990s way, like pro gay rights, perhaps pro gay marriage, very freaked out about trans issues, and very pro-Israel. And I think that that is her audience and her cohort and her business model through the free press. It's been continuous, going back to the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the free press, has been to try to capture this audience, because she, that is the world she came from. She genuinely thinks that this is the sort of center of American life. And in a lot of ways, it has been. I should mention, David's working on a history of sort of neoconservatism. And I think one way to understand Barry Weiss in the sort of grand sweep of history is that She's a product of this neoconservative faction, which has been powerful well outside its numbers. Like it's never been more than, you know, like if one is being like wildly generous, like maybe a few hundred thousand people, right? Like in a nation of 300 million. But because it occupies specific positions within like sort of like media, intellectual life, and also because it is a genuinely centrist faction in the sense that it swings between Republicans and Democrats, and therefore is something that like both political parties have pursued. It's a very powerful faction. So yeah. I mean, like, so I think to the extent that she's like sort of like carrying on the sort of torch of neoconservatism and trying to please that audience in an era where like neoconservativism is actually like in a lot of arguably in a lot of trouble on both political parties. Both the sort of, you know, traditional Democrats, you know, like are moving wildly towards rejecting Israel on human rights grounds. And on the Republican Party side, you see a lot of people also rejecting the sort of neoconservative pro-Israel politics on, you know, like
isolationist and anti-Semitic grounds.
On anti-Semitic grounds, on basically Christian nationalist grounds.
Yeah.
That like, you know, like we don't want the Jews. This is a Christian country. And why are we letting the Jews run our foreign policy?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, but precisely because neoconservatism is endangered, because that old sort of like centrist, establishment centrist politics is now threatened and in danger, that means that people are invested in it. And that this, you know, basically means, like, if we're being frank, like a lot of people are billionaires. A lot of people are like, you know, like very wealthy, are very still vested in this politics. They are willing to like back it because they still think, as Barry Weiss does, that this is actually like the real centrist America. We just have to sell it. So she does believe her own. I have to say we're under FCC rules. So she believes her own BS, but like all good sort of con people. But it's also the case that the main thing is to try to sell this product. She's been tasked with the selling a product that really is not popular anymore, but will still be put on the marketplace because, you know, that core audience of very wealthy, very elite people still want to try to, like, you know, sell it to the American people.
So I agree with most of what you said. I obviously agree and will argue in my book that Barry is an heir to the neoconservative tradition, if not the heir. I agree with your assessment of neoconservatism's numbers, its past influence out of proportion to its numbers, its current decline in popularity, and how it's sort of hanging on tenaciously in elite positions, despite that, with Barry being a real case in point. I agree with all of that. To me, the central question is, as long as we're focused on Barry, though, is does she understand that, in fact, this is not going to work from a ratings and popularity point of view? It may very well work from a, you know, Donald Trump approves the merger view, it probably will, and a, you know, the Ellisons get richer as a result point of view, although how much richer could they possibly be? But, you know, there's no question she's rich, there's no question she's powerful, and there's no question that she's an ideologue. But does she intend to destroy the news network she's been put in charge of and leave it with, you know, half the audience it had before? Or does she actually believe that she's going to compete and win? Because let me just lay out some pieces of evidence for the scope of the destruction, as well as what I think is her earnest attempt to make it otherwise. So let's start with CBS Evening News, right? Barry, it has been widely reported and not refuted, asked two different people for the CBS Evening News job who turned her down. One of them was Anderson Cooper, and one of them was Bret Baier. Now, Anderson Cooper is most famous for CNN, where he has a contract. He also had, for like 20 years, been appearing on 60 Minutes, the hottest property on CBS, which we'll talk about in a sec. And he turned her down, and he left 60 Minutes. So she not only didn't get him as a nightly news anchor, she also lost him in another core property she runs. She clearly likes him, or she wouldn't have asked him. And I think it would be a real stretch to call Anderson Cooper a neocon or a conservative. He's certainly establishment. He's certainly like a known quantity. He's not a leftist or a radical in any way. But I don't think he's in any sense an ideologue or someone you would pick if you were trying to suck up to Donald Trump. I think that getting Anderson Cooper away from CNN is purely a prestige play. It's the kind of thing you would do if you were a very gutsy and ambitious head of a TV network, and you were just trying to make successful TV and get your ratings up, and it failed. Bret Baier is at Fox News, so he's kind of conservative coded, but he's seen as a straight shooter and a serious news anchor. He also turned her down. And there was a recent interview with Semaphore where Ben Smith and Max Tani tried to get him to say anything nice or mean about Barry's tenure, and he was very cagey about it. But I definitely got the impression he doesn't respect her much at all. Cooper clearly doesn't respect her much because of the way he went out on 60 Minutes and the message he gave there, which was universally interpreted as a jab at her and which she was reportedly furious about. So her first two attempts, both at kind of middle of the road anchors, maybe one a little left of center, one a little right of center, failed, at which point she promotes Tony DeCoupel. So anyone who thought, for instance, oh, Tony DeCoupel is getting the job because, you know, he's a right-wing Zionist who embarrassed Ta-Nehisi Coates a year earlier. I mean, it's true that he had this terrible exchange with Ta-Nehisi Coates a year earlier, and it's true that Barry registered it, and it probably turned into the memo that helped her get hired. But it's pretty well established that DeCoupel was the third person, at most, that she asked to fill this role. Now, he's not, despite his pro-Israel politics, considered a right-winger or an ideologue in any way. He's basically a genial doofus morning news host, which he was good at, but which is a very different skill set than being a primetime news anchor. He doesn't have the gravitas for it. So he came in, and his whole debut was a series of catastrophic amateur hour errors, both from him and from Barry and her production. And their ratings are terrible. Their ratings are so bad that even though, you know, Barry defenders might argue, well, you know, as Barry has implied various times, that in a few years, like, broadcast news won't exist. Well, in the short term, ABC and NBC are actually growing at CBS's expense. That's how badly they're doing. Their ratings are
accelerating
actually
the decline at her own network.
and helping her rise.
Whereas your goal should be to slow down the decline. Yeah. I know.
So no aspect of the story I've just told, I think, squares with a narrative that says, oh, this is what she wanted. This is exactly how she wants it to go.
I wouldn't say like everything she does is a sort of like business success, but I do actually think that there is the ideological project is what is guiding it. And I would also say, I mean, if we're thinking about it like in a sort of like broad sweep of neoconservative history and what she represents from that, I think the fact that she wants to get sort of like mainstream voices to be part of this project is consistent with neoconservatism. Neoconservatism emerged, you know, as we'll see in your forthcoming book, we're all like eagerly waiting for, emerged out of Cold War liberalism, which went through a crisis in the 60s with the rise of the new left. And at its most, I think, successful phase, which is in the 60s and 70s, the neoconservatives were able to recruit a lot of former liberals. They themselves were former liberals, but also present a kind of liberal face to it. They were saying, like, we're liberals who are mugged by reality.
Yeah.
And one looks at it, like, the sort of commentary of the 60s and even, like, going up to 1973 often featured Irving Howe, you know, who's like Mr. Social Democracy, like the leading social democratic intellectual, but was like publishing articles in commentary against the new left. And that was the ideal position that they had, which is that if you could present like someone who's like, you know, respected and loved by the left liberals to critique the left, you can like most persuasively push liberals to the right. And yeah. I think that has been the project. Now, I think what
Barry totally lacks this, though, as is evident at the Free Press. She basically cannot persuade a person whose respect on the left to work for her
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're at a different phase of history. I think the sort of neoconservatism of the 60s and 70s was very successful, partially because there was a lot of legitimate things one could attack the left for. There were a lot of people coming from a liberal background who had doubts about the new left, and we're able to like land a lot of real punches, and partially because the people running for them were actually like came from the left and came from an actual left. They actually were Cold War liberals, but had a deeper root
in the
anti-Stalinist Trotskyist left.
Yeah,
and so therefore they could land punches and could like actually knew the arguments. Now we're in a sort of like, that was like 60 years ago, right? We're in a sort of like decadent phase of neoconservatism, where it no longer has that ability to persuade. Not only can't they find like left-wing turncoats to make their arguments, they can't find liberal turncoats to make their arguments for the most part, except for, you know, like very sad people like Matt Taibbi or whatever.
Oh my God. He doesn't count anymore.
Yeah, or, you know, like people are like or people like, you know, Tracy, you know, like people are like genuinely pathetic weirdos. Now, so her, I mean, I think her, the problem with her, like, she has the same ideological project, but it's running through real difficulties because it's actually hard to recruit any liberal, you know, even like someone like Anderson Cooper, like who I think is a genuine, you know, middle of the road centrist type, but, you know, doesn't want to be part of like whitewashing like Trump, right? Like, I think the Trump presidency is so odious to so many people on so many different grounds. Well,
it's not just about Trump. It's not just about Trump.
But the wider right, yeah.
And it's not just about the wider right. I think it's even more basic than that. I think Barry Weiss is a commissar. She's not a journalist. And I think she's pretty universally understood as such right now. Even her supporters basically say that. They just say it as if it's a good thing. Barry Weiss is not someone who is committed to journalistic ideals. Now, I say this, I want to make clear like what I, like how strongly I mean that, because there are a lot of people who I vocally, publicly have a lot of issues with, who I think fail in various ways at true journalistic objectivity, or have a pretense of journalistic objectivity that is belied by some of their actual decisions. But I want to say that I think Barry is in another category. Some of those are people who have been in the past tight with Barry. It's unclear if they still are. People like Atlantic editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg, or CNN anchor Jake Tapper, who may or may not soon be working for Barry. These are two guys who share a lot of Barry's ideology, especially when it comes to Israel, pretty clearly, and I think related to her for that reason. And there is this persistent blind spot in, I think, American mainstream media, where being extremely pro-Israel is not seen as a departure from objectivity. At CNN pre-Barry, we have Dana Bash, who clearly is a Hasbro's propagandist. We have Wolf Blitzer, who's worked directly for the Israeli government. I mean, it's really something. And, you know, there's examples of this at the New York Times and elsewhere, too. Even so, I think Barry takes it to another category. I think even those people, though they genuinely and delusionally believe that their pro-Israel agenda is simply objectivity and, you know, not open for debate, and doesn't compromise their objectivity as journalists, I think they still believe in the concept of objectivity as journalists. I think they still believe, and on like a wide variety of issues, that they can cover things in an objective and balanced way, and following certain, you know, journalism 101 norms of, you know, getting the right number of sources to confirm a thing, or, you know, making sure that a source is not compromised in some way by, you know, by some conflict of interest, some just basic things like that, that I think even in the breach, guys like that usually respect. And Barry Weiss has no journalistic ethics or integrity whatsoever. She is, I think, working anywhere close to her level, and there aren't many people at her level anymore with her current job, but even going back like a year before she had this job, of like prominent people in media, I think she is quite possibly the most ethically bankrupt. She's certainly way up there. I mean, she just does not, like, journalism to her is purely a vessel for propaganda. You know, she sees CBS that way. She wants to turn CBS into a propaganda channel. I mean, the things that she did with the Sikot story at 60 Minutes have essentially nothing to do with Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that, like, Barry's history actually is not particularly as an anti-immigration voice. In fact, in the first Trump administration, when she was still kind of casting herself as an idiosyncratic never Trump liberal, not unlike a lot of neocons, some of whom, like Bill Kristol, are still, you know, clearly in that camp a decade later. In Barry's case, she, you know, one of the reasons she parted ways with Trump was that she thought that his rhetoric on immigrants was horrible. She said so publicly. Now, maybe she was cynically positioning herself then. She probably was. We live in a different world now. But it's just to say, you know, Barry has always been a pro-Israel fanatic. She has always fought against the Israel critical left and against Palestinians. That's a through line of her entire, you know, back to college at least, career. The immigration stuff is not a through line at all. Why did she do the CECOT stuff? I mean, presumably to suck up to Donald Trump. But that, like, was step one in basically destroying 60 Minutes. So to talk about 60 Minutes a little bit, 60 Minutes is successful. 60 Minutes was up, you know, 9% in ratings during the last year, mostly under Barry's watch, because she mostly...
Oh, it probably is the most successful brand in certainly, like, television news and arguably in American journalism.
Right.
You know, it's like super, like, popular, well-known and respected.
Period. So the cover story that Barry and the Ellisons have about how they need to remake, you know, the news because it's dying really doesn't fit 60 Minutes, even if it fit everything else that CBS is doing. And 60 Minutes also kind of operated as its own walled off, you know, kingdom. So while the people there may not have been happy about what she was doing, I think they generally understood that if she left 60 Minutes alone, or, you know, mostly left it alone, they would be fine. She has not left it alone. The CECOT thing was blatantly bad management, except insofar as it probably made a good impression on the Trump administration. As a result of it, she ended up firing a bunch of longtime employees, which infuriated Scott Pelley so much that he, at a meeting that was covered by every single reporter, even though it should have been a private meeting, you know, told her new toady, Nick Bilton, that he has no qualifications for the job and that Barry has no qualifications for the job, and got applause from a whole room of 60 Minutes employees for doing that. So at that point, Bilton and Weiss pretty much had to fire Scott Pelley. I mean, that's such rank and subordination. And they did. Now, though, Bilton is desperately trying to keep the remaining talent, Leslie Stahl and so on, from leaving. They've put out a message basically saying if there's any more editorial intervention from Barry, like, that won't be tolerated. We'll see who's bluffing there. But it's clear that Barry has done enormous damage to 60 Minutes, and I don't think anyone thinks it's over. I don't think anyone thinks... And so I just have to ask, like, is that really what she and Ellison want for, like, the single most valuable TV news brand there is, which they own, to just be a shell? Like, was that the goal? And to, like, lose all of its audience?
I mean, I don't think, like, they want to lose their audience, but I think, like, it's a price that they're willing to pay for the larger project, which is, first of all, to please Trump, and then also to, you know, remake CBS News, including 60 Minutes, as a sort of Trump-friendly, right-wing-friendly place. I mean, like, I think I think that she has convinced the Ellisons and a wider cohort of wealthy people that, you know, the way to save news is to replicate Fox News, that there's a lot of people who have turned away from mainstream news because it's too liberal. And she sold them that story.
The abundant rating evidence to the contrary.
No, I'm not saying that what she's doing is successful or coherent or, like, makes sense. But it is what she wants. And I think that the Ellison family are willing to go along with it because, you know, it is the case that they're pleasing Trump. I mean, one could also say, like, you know, something that Barry Weiss was not involved with, which is the, you know, canceling of Stephen Colbert, didn't make a lot of sense on a business angle. All of Colbert's audience seems to have gone over to Jimmy Kimmel. So they basically, you know, have enriched their rivals. But it was something that made Trump very happy and made him, like approve it. So I think all of this is
what happens
with the program that you're arguing with, which is what I sort of believed, which is that, you know, like, she is involved in a sort of ideological political project for which, you know, making money is secondary. And she has the luxury of it being secondary because the people that she's trying to please are wealthy for other reasons. They're wealthy because of this merger. They're wealthy because America is a plutocracy. And the plutocrats are willing to lose some ratings in order to have, like, a stranglehold on mainstream news to both promote Donald Trump and then also to make sure that, like, criticism of Israel is tamped down upon. I mean, is that a successful business model? I think we can agree that it's not.
But well, do they have a stranglehold on mainstream news? I mean, they don't control every channel. They're losing ratings to the channels that aren't doing this. And also, Donald Trump is most likely not going to be president in 2 years or so. And like at some point, there will be Democrats in office again. So like what? Who is it they're chasing exactly?
Well, I mean, on the Democrat side, like I actually do think that like one aspect of this is it's asymmetrical, right? Like if Donald Trump is unhappy, he will punish CBS and the Ellison family. A lot of Democrats are mad that we at the Nation are complaining. But what are they gonna like? Do we actually think that it's gonna be reprisals?
No, of course. I mean, it would be. We would live in a, what's that meme you see on Twitter where people post the like futuristic city landscape, like that, but for the prospect of like AOC run FCC that just like, you know, destroys the Ellison empire and
utilizes
them. I mean, we should be so lucky, but
within that asymmetrical background where like, you know, one party is like willing to hurt you and the other party will roll over, then like I think a lot of what CBS is doing, what the Ellison family are doing, makes sense. I mean it is the case that
Gary personally cares at all that like she will go down in the history books as basically someone who destroyed American institutions for like terrible ratings and was just like does that bother her at all? Like the someone who once wanted to like the respect of her media peers.
It's a question of whether, you know, like armor prop is guiding it. I mean, like, again, I'll return to the sort of like history of neoconservatism, like, and one can compare it as a figure like Norman Potter, it's where like on the one hand, like he lost everything, right? Like he had wanted to be a respected New York intellectual, to be praised in the New York Review of Books, to have like people like Hannah Arendt and Mary McCarthy say like, you're the young genius. And, you know, like through publishing of Making It and then his right wing turn, it like all the people his respect he wanted, like basically said, you're an idiot, right? And then like letters came out where Hannah Arendt and Mary McCarthy are writing back and forth, can you believe this Norman Potter? He's an idiot. And he has to read all these letters from the people who's like the thing he most wanted, the respect of these people, and realize that everyone that like his approval he craved thought that he's one of the biggest morons in history.
On the other hand,
he got like became a powerful figure in American politics, got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you know, led a movement that like reshaped the Republican Party and like led the war in Iraq and is now leading the war in Iran.
Posthumously, but yes.
Yeah, posthumously. But I think he was he still
He died in December, but there had been some initial.
There was a bombing last June. He missed
the full scale war by like 2 months.
Yeah. So basically, like if you think that like what a figure like Potter wants is armor prop, like, you know, like the respect of people whose respect I crave, then he was a total loser. If you think like, you know, like what he wanted was to be a powerful figure in American life, then like, you know, he was unfortunately one of the most powerful intellectuals that we've had in the last 70 years. Someone who like really reshaped American politics, you know, and like is pretty directly responsible for like at least two or three major wars.
I mean, I largely agree. I mean, there's only so much credit he personally deserves, but I largely agree. And it has certainly occurred to me that there's a lot of spiritual DNA from Norman Podhoretz
what he got out of it as well, not just like that he got the political benefits, but he got a lot of financial benefits. He got plutocrats to constantly fund this money-losing magazine so he could live like a good upper middle class life, and he got them to subsidize his idiot unemployable son, you know, who would not otherwise have a job, and then continue to fund him after he's dead.
All of this is going directly in the book, of course. But
so did Norman Podhoretz lose or did he win? And I think the same applies.
The last line of my obit I wrote in December was, "One must imagine Norman Podhoretz happy." So you know my answer on this. Look, I think this could all be right. I mean, maybe Barry really does want, but That said, no one ever put Norman Podhoretz in charge of a major media empire. You know, he ran a money-losing magazine, but they're all money-losing. And commentary was, you know, buzzy and influential. I mean, you know, similarly, I think that if you rewind a year, Barry is doing quite well on something like the Norman Podhoretz trajectory. You know, she left the New York Times because she flamed out because all the liberals hated her. She had her sort of dark side turn where she just embraced the right. She founded the Free Press. She got a bunch of rich people to fund it. And the Free Press was succeeding. The Free Press, or at least it gave the appearances of succeeding. I mean, who knows how much of this was inflated or whatever. But, you know, it certainly seemed to have a large paying subscriber base and a much larger non-paying subscriber base. It was, you know, punching above its weight. It had a big staff. It was...
No, it's spoken about taking...
She could credibly go around town and did in the year before she got the CBS job. She could credibly go around New York, which she'd returned to from her exile in California. She could credibly go around being like, I showed you all. I showed you all that I can, on my own, through my own brilliance and talent, create a digital media site, which is, you know, basically in our fallen world, the equivalent of a small, you know, of a little magazine like Commentary. I can found something like that, and it can be a success by any normal standard of what would be successful there. But the thing is, a success for a site like that is like you have 100,000 paid subscribers or whatever, who, and you know, everyone who works for that site is someone who wanted to work for Barry Weiss's site, right? Though there are stories about her horrible management of them too. But setting that aside, they're people who bought into what they thought her ideological project is. They signed up for the job. They applied for that job. They wanted to work for the Free Press, not for somewhere else. And so she could run a place built that was very much the Barry Weiss show. And, you know, I criticized her vociferously during that period, but... And I criticize the Free Press's ethics and the way it covers things, but I didn't like, it seemed totally like she was within her rights to create such a site. Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of grudgingly acknowledge that it seemed to be going well for her. But she has no business running CBS News. And she certainly has no business running CNN. And she's now running an organization staffed by thousands. Literally every single person down to the lowliest intern is like better qualified to run a TV news channel than she is. They all know it. They all know she's there because of, you know, her ability to suck up to a billionaire who is himself a fail son who didn't earn any of his fortune and for ideological reasons. She has no relevant experience. The circle of loyalists around her, people like Adam Rubinstein, also have no relevant experience. And the audience, like, I think it's like CBS Evening News. She's like managed to take it from 4 million to 3 million or something like that. And those are very rough numbers. But like, it's just an order of magnitude bigger, at least, than what she was dealing with the Free Press. So like, it only works if you believe that they really do welcome all the chaos and all the destruction and all the, like, if I mean... The first line in her obituary is going to be like, she destroyed CBS News and she destroyed 60 Minutes, you know, like that is the thing she has accomplished in her life. Significant, but it's not like what most people would consider an accomplishment.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, from her point of view and the Ellison's point of view, it's like, you know, 60 Minutes is like, you know, small price to pay.
No, I get it. Especially, you know, from the Ellison.
And the thing is, I mean, like, you know, like it's Machiavelli, like, you know, it's better to be feared than loved, because if they fear you, they will love you in the end. So,
well, I think what we have seen is that although there are people who fear her, almost no one loves her except for her loyalists.
Sure. But does it matter as long as people fear you? You know, like as long as, I mean, this is a kind of end game of, you know, her type of politics and really, frankly, her type of Zionist. Like, it doesn't matter if, you know, people love Israel as long as they fear it. It doesn't matter if, like, Israeli advocates in America are respected or loved, you know, as long as people, like, fear them and certain ideas and criticism of Israel are off limits.
Well, for the first time in anyone's memory, I think it is plausible that within a few years, neither party will be reflexively pro-Israel. And that will be a sea change in Israel's status and the status of the Israel lobby. And you can see the panic everywhere.
Yeah, I know. But the panic helps her in the short term, because that's why, you know, the Ellisons want to support her. I mean, yeah, in the long term, I mean, she's tied to like what I think of as a dangerous and doomed project. But I mean,
well, and just in crass political terms, like, we could have the party of Tucker Carlson and the party of, you know, AOC very soon.
No. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, like, in that sense, like, whether she'll get what she wants is questionable. But like, in terms of like trying to shore up the positions that like she and her cohort have and they want to maintain, I mean, she is, you know, getting what she wants. I mean, yeah. So, you know, the time will tell, but that might be a good note to end on. So I want to once again thank David Kleon. It's always great talking about Barry Weiss, and I think we've maybe given a wider context to where she stands in than is otherwise available.
I hope so. Always a pleasure.
The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI? Or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.